The ship is much bigger than the grab that dangles beneath it on the end of 3 miles of steel pipe, but it's at the grab's mercy. 3 miles of pipe makes for a prodigious pendulum, and as the grab sinks slowly through the deep ocean currents, the ship has to maneuver frantically to stay on top of it in the 6-foot swells. Exotic domes on top of the vessel's bridge suck down transmissions from the Navy's transit positioning satellites, feeding them to the automatic station-keeping system that controls the ship's bow and stern thrusters, and the cylindrical surge compensators that the derrick rests on. Like a swan, it looks peaceful on the surface, but under the waterline there's a hive of frantic activity. Everything, the entire 400 megabuck investment, 10 years of company black operations, depends on what happens in the next few hours, when they reach the bottom. Steve turns back to his TV screen. It's another miracle of technology. The barge has cameras and floodlights, vacuum tubes designed to function in the abyssal depths. But his camera is flaking out, static hash marching up the screen in periodic waves. The pressure, tons per square inch, is damaging the waterproof cables that carry power and signal.
"This is shit," he complains. "We're never going to spot it. If..."
He trails off. Good Time Norm at the next desk is standing up, pointing at something on his screen. There's a whoop from the other side of the room. He squints at his screen, and between the lines of static, he sees a rectilinear outline.
"Holy..."
The public address system crackles overhead.
"Clementine, crew, K-129 on screens 2 and 5. Range approximately 50 feet, bearing 225. Stand by, find thruster control."
It's official. They've found what they're looking for. The atmosphere in Spook City is tense but triumphant.
"We're there,"
announces Cooper. He smirks at the hatchet-faced Brit in the crumpled suit who is smoking an unfiltered Camel in clear violation of shipboard fire regulations.
"We did it."
"We'll see," mutters the Brit.
He stubs the cigarette out and shakes his head.
"Getting there is only half the struggle."
Nettled, Murph glares at him.
"What's your problem?" he demands.
"You're messing with something below 1,000 meters, in strict contravention of Article 4,
says the Brit.
"I'm here as a neutral observer in accordance with Section 2.
"Fuck you and your neutral status. You're just sore because you guys don't have the balls to stand on your waiver rights."
Cooper gets between them before things can escalate again.
"Cool it. Murph, how about checking with the bridge again to see if there's been any sign of the commies taking an interest? They'll twig when they see we've stopped lowering the string. James?"
He pauses, grimaces slightly. The Brit's alias is transparent, and to a company man, borderline insulting. Cooper wonders, not for the first time, why the fuck does he call himself that?
"Let's go take a hike down to the moon pool and see what they've found."
"Suits me."
The Brit stands up, unfolding like a stick insect inside his badly fitting gray suit. His cheek twitches, but his expression stays frozen.
"After you."
They leave the office and Cooper locks the door behind him. The Hughes GMDI ship may be enormous. It's bigger than a Marine Corps assault carrier, larger than an Iowa-class battleship. But its companionways and corridors are a cramped gray maze, punctuated by color-coded pipes and ducts conveniently located at shin-scraping and head-banging heights. It doesn't roll in the swells, but it rocks weirdly, held solidly on station by the SKS thrusters, a new technology that accounts for a goodly chunk of the cost of the ship. Down 6 flights of steps, there's another passage and a bulkhead. Then Cooper sees the dogged back hatch leaning out into the moon pool at the level of the 50-foot catwalk. As usual, it takes his breath away. The moon pool is just under 200 feet long and 75 feet wide. A stillness of black water surrounded by the gantries and cranes required for servicing the barge. The giant docking legs are fully extended below the waterline at either end of the pool. The drill string pierces the heart of the chamber like a black steel spear, tying it to the ocean floor. The automatic roughneck and the string handling systems have fallen silent, the deafening clatter and roar of the drill system shut down now that the grab has reached its target. Soon, if all goes well, the derrick above them will begin hauling up the string, laboriously unbolting the hundreds of pipe segments and stacking them on the deck of the ship until finally Clementine, also known as the HMB-1 mining barge, rumbles to the surface of the pool in a flurry of cold water, clutching its treasure beneath it. But for now, the moon pool is a peaceful haven, its surface marred only by shallow, oily ripples.